case of Bryant versus the Commonwealth. We're ready when you are.
Yes, sir.
May it please the court, Mr. Campbell. Good morning. I'd like to bring the attention to the court. The defendant, appellant, is present in the courtroom, observing the arguments.
Very well, thank you. And you, Mr. Graves?
I'm Andrew Graves from Harrisonburg, Virginia.
And do you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
3 minutes.
Sir. 3 minutes, yes, sir.
Thank you. The case of Tina Marie Bryant, essentially, as the two issues I spelled out within the in the brief, dealt with sufficiency of the evidence is the first issue, and then second, denial of a jury instruction. And the case involved the unlawful discharge of a firearm within an occupied dwelling. And not in contest in this case are the endangerment issue, because that issue has been solved long ago.
But there was a discharge of a weapon, it was an occupied building, and so the issue really boils down to this may have been an accidental
Absolutely. Event. And that's why I say there's no question that there was testimony at trial that the hotel was near max occupancy. There was testimony at trial the gun discharged. And what's interesting, when reading this, you get back to the case law that goes to a non-intentional discharge. And when you read through case law, it appears that under 18.279, it's void, because in most of the cases, like Fleming, and most of the cases, like even the unpublished opinion in Chambers, indicate issues. Now, Chambers, this court withheld determining whether it was an intentional or non-intentional discharge, because Chambers initially says, it's my house, I can shoot what I want. And then later says, I didn't mean to shoot, which is entirely different than this case. And then we go into the cases that really deal a lot of times with shooting at an occupied structure, like Fleming. I believe in Fleming there was over 20 rounds shot, showing specifically this person intended to shoot. That's what's different in this case. Evidentiary-wise, we have Tina Marie Bryant in a hotel room, suicidal. She is then greeted by a very brave law enforcement officer. She came to the scene to try to talk her down, to try to prevent her from taking her own life. And ultimately, we're successful in that venture, as the evidence would have to support for there to be an intentional discharge, certainly some sort of circumstantial evidence. But the testimony through the trial was that the discharge occurred at a time where she was calming down, where she was reasoning with them.
Counsel, she had her finger on the trigger at the time, even by her own testimony, she had her finger on the trigger at the time the gun went off, correct?
That is accurate. She said she was calming down, and then she testifies, and I would say that she testified unimpeached, that she was putting the gun down when it discharged.
But even if it's criminal negligence, that's sufficient under that section of the code for conviction, isn't it?
It could be interpreted that way. The issue that I think I brought, and I brought it forth at trial, is that we accept this fashion that intent can occur in the blink of an eye, then why can't abandonment occur in the blink of an eye as well? It would have to be considered an act of abandonment when she points the gun away from her head to put it down, which she testified to, and as she did, she says that her finger hit the trigger and the gun discharged.
But counsel, I think what Judge Huff is getting at, the mens rea for 18.279 is criminal negligence, and you can have an accident and it still be criminally negligent, correct?
You can, but I think you have to look at the specific circumstances of the accident. I believe there was a recent case where the court considered a person who threw a television out of a window and hit a sailboat. In that case, there was a dissent. It may not be that recent, thinking back, but there was a dissent in that indicated, you know, looking through the testimony, the questioning about did he throw the TV out the window, or was he led to, you know, to say that it happened during the course of a struggle. I think that even most recently, though, let's go as recent as March 14th, 2017, Holsinger versus Commonwealth. This court actually mentions Fleming again, and says specific intent to shoot a part of a building must be established by the Commonwealth. And I think that is the part of the statute that's still required. There still has to be that intent to discharge the weapon.
And that would be a fact finding?
That would be a fact finding that a fact finder could determine, but if they're misled on the instructions and not given a proper instruction as to that an accident may say, if it's an accident instruction could have entirely acquitted her that day.
Well, on the sufficiency issue, let me think. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Going on all kinds of different directions.
No,
what I would suggest is that we also think about the jury. The jury, fortunately, in this case, the jury did communicate. The jury communicated with two very important questions. You know, what if it was an accident? Do they have to show intent? And we left those answers blank to the jury. And then they spoke again with their verdict. You know, after they were made aware, you must have believed that there was some intent. You must have. They came back with a fine of $0 as her punishment.
There was evidence that this was a 7-pound pole required to discharge.
There was, and then Tommy James was the expert. There was objection. We didn't pursue that on appeal. I went to boot camp with Tommy James in the Marine Corps. great guy, but they also testified that if it was already set at a, asked if it was a single pull trigger or double action, didn't have an answer for that. I said, well, double action's half that. He said, yes. And then the court and every officer testified about things called sympathetic reactions, and the court even addressed it during the motion to set aside. A sympathetic reaction could cause a person to pull the trigger.
But if we're required on appeal to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, don't we need to take into account this 7-pound pole and that this was a fact determination that makes it an almost impossible hurdle for you, doesn't it?
Maybe as to the sufficiency of the evidence, but as the proponent of the jury instruction, we get that view from the court. We get to be viewed as the one, it's viewed in our favor.
But on, well, that's right. The proponent of the evidence will be viewed in the light most favorable to the proponent of the instruction. But as far as the instruction goes, accident is not a defense to this statute, is it? If there's criminal negligence, it still could be accidental.
I would say because of the rationale from all the case law that I've read, even the Attorney General opinion that I cited, it was 1978, indicates the Commonwealth still must prove an intentional shooting. And I think that's the whole issue, and that's why I believe the accident instruction would apply, because with the accident instruction's application, I think accident instruction could apply to anything that's not strict liability. And we brought that forward in the motion to set aside as well, saying, essentially, if we believe it to be this way, we believe this is a strict liability case. And that was part of the argument. And
but counsel, it's not a strict liability statute.
It is not.
Okay. And criminal negligence, you can have an accident and still be criminally negligent. And her finger on, even under the defense evidence, her finger was on the trigger.
Yes.
And in fact, she received injury from the pullback.
Absolutely.
So she obviously, I mean, for the instruction piece, we look at it in the light most favorable to the defense. And in the light most favorable to the defense, her finger was on the trigger, and she was injured by the slide of the gun.
She was injured by the slide of the gun, and the reason that testimony was elicited was due to the fact to show that she was not a person who had experienced.
Understood, but the evidence is what the evidence is.
It is, and that was really the purpose and how we were intending to demonstrate that to the jury, because the Commonwealth tried to argue that she was a seasoned firearm user, a seasoned person who used guns. We were demonstrating that she really wasn't. She was certainly under a mental distress that day and kept coming out of it. And
I don't think there's any doubt, counsel, from the facts of the case, this was a tragic situation.
Absolutely.
And I think that the jury obviously saw that.
Absolutely. I think when I read the case, again, there isn't a lot going towards this issue. And I was talking about Fleming and the 20 rounds that were fired, and I talk about an Armstead where they specify, and there again, the, you know, this language, intent to shoot, you know, and then to be brought back up by a holstering, I still think that specific intent is still an issue. And the only reason I say it's an issue is to get the jury instruction in. It seems, and it's never known what a jury's going to do, but it seems based on what they say in their verdict that an accident instruction in this case would have led to an acquittal. And we believe that it would be proper under their circumstances. The other cases that deal with intentional discharge typically deal with people who were very angry or intoxicated. And in her case, she was under a mental distress, but as Sergeant Mike Deeds testified to in the trial, that she was calming down. And again, the discharge occurred at an unusual point in time during their communication with her. And again, I brought up Chambers only because the court decided that the person was uncredible and the trier of fact had determined the credibility between the two statements. I did bring it up only again because, and I know I'm running out of time, is because in that case there was a judge. The judge is presumed to know the law and argued it, motion to set aside. A jury does not. A jury is instructed in law and a jury is to act within the confines of what they're told. And I would suggest that the Commonwealth is required to show this wasn't an accident, and they didn't do that. And for those reasons combined, I would ask that either one, the case be reviewed and dismissed, or two, that this case be remanded for a new trial with the accident instruction.
Very well. Thank you, sir. For the Commonwealth, Mr. Campbell.
Good morning. May it please support Aaron Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth. I'd like to begin by talking about the accident defense. And it's our position that the accident defense was inappropriate because it's a criminal negligence statute. And I want to point out something that I didn't brief. It just sort of occurred to me when I was reading the statute, which happens often. but you know, the statute says that if you unlawfully discharge a firearm and someone dies, then that is involuntary manslaughter, which by definition is an accidental killing and is criminal negligence. So it would make sense to me that the term unlawfully in the statute is means criminal negligence. And it tracks with the case law that says that traditionally the term unlawfully is, the mens rea is criminal negligence. I would submit, though, that perhaps the best case for the appellant is probably, well, two cases, Fleming and Ellis, that say that the statute, when you're shooting at an occupied dwelling, is a general intent crime. But if you look at the Ellis in particular, I'd like to read a little bit from Ellis, because it certainly seems that what the court in Ellis was saying is that there could be a conviction when there is criminal negligence. And what the court says is that the legislative purpose of the statute is meant to prohibit unlawful conduct, whether malicious or merely criminally reckless, which has the potential to endanger the lives of persons inside occupied buildings without regard to the shooter's actual intent or actual motive or intent in unlawfully discharging a firearm. So it's our position that this is actually a criminal negligence statute. And you know, as for the sufficiency, as the court has pointed out, that we get the evidence in the light most favorable to us. The evidence really is that the defendant was suicidal. She put the gun to her head and she started to squeeze the trigger, and then she decided to remove it. We would argue that that is, by definition, a reckless handling of the firearm, which in itself is a crime, because and should not be a defense to this charge of unlawfully discharging a firearm.
Counsel, can I interrupt you and ask you back to the accident issue?
Yeah.
Is there ever a scenario where under this code section a defendant would be entitled to an accident instruction?
I cannot envision one because it's criminal negligence. I think what you could argue is that, say that there's a struggle like there was in the King case. What you could argue is that I wasn't acting criminally negligent in that struggle.
Kind of a superseding intervening cause type of argument.
Yeah.
What about a hunter who goes back to the hotel room and is cleaning his or her gun for the next day of hunting, and is and the gun malfunctions and it goes off?
Again, maybe what he's doing is he's performing a lawful act. I wouldn't say that he is criminally negligent because there's nothing. He's not acting recklessly. I think that would be the
discharge
defense.
The firearm in the motel room.
I think his argument to the court would be I was not acting with criminal negligence. You know, it may have been an accident, but I think the appropriate probably argument to the court would be that this was not criminal negligence rather than this was an accident that needed to be have an accident instruction. I think at least in this case, it would be confusing to the jury to give this accident instruction when what happened was potentially an accident, but still criminal negligence. And I think that is what the trial judge was really wrestling with, is that how do I give this instruction without determining,
it seems the trial judge was grappling with very able counsel, by the way, at trial.
Yeah.
It seems that the trial judge was trying to balance what to do with a general intent crime and what that level of general intent was, and where in the statutory language the intent fell.
Right.
And so. He kind of got wrapped around, he stuck with the model jury instructions because that was the clearest route for the jury.
Absolutely. But then in the motion to set aside, I think he went back and looked at the case law of Scott and the which was prompted by this court's decision in Crowder, and ultimately decided that I think that this is a criminal negligence statute, and I think he was correct I do think it leaves the court in a weird situation, is that the appellant below just argued there was lack of intent. And if we don't have the proof intent, where does that leave us now? I mean, he really hasn't argued criminal negligence. If we did have the proof intent, I mean, it's a jury issue. It was argued to the jury that this was, by both, this was no accident, that this was intentional, and the jury didn't found that this was. They may have, I understand that the type of sentence and the questions that they seem like they were grappling with it, but when you view the evidence in light most favorable to the Commonwealth, I think you have to.
Well, and isn't part of that questioning because part of closing argument for the defense was it was an accident.
Yeah, it was.
And so they.
Yeah.
They went back with the instructions and were trying to figure out how accident played
that,
into it.
Yeah, where does that fit in? And I understand that. And the argument is accident shouldn't have played into it, but here we are. I will point out a couple things just on the sufficiency. Even viewing the evidence of light most favorable to the Commonwealth, she didn't drop the gun. The officer testified that she actually came to the window and pointed it at them. There was some credibility issues, whether or not she told the officer that she went to the shooting range, and then she testified that she had never shot a gun in her life. All that, I think, goes against her and in favor of the Commonwealth under the sufficiency argument. It's an interesting case legally, and I recognize it is a sad case, but I think under the law, I think the Commonwealth has met their burden under both of these issues. And if the court has any questions, I just ask that the court affirm.
Thank you, sir. Rebuttal, Mr. Graves?
Yes. I guess in response, the Commonwealth would say that a series of events would lead to a criminal negligent action. And then I, again, my brief argued that there was an abandonment. Now, there was an abandonment of the desire to kill oneself. And then there was an action that was demonstrated in court where she took the gun and was putting it down. Now, that is an action that could be a person putting a gun into their nightstand beside their bed where they sleep with it at night. That could be an entirely not criminally negligent. That could just be as simple, I'm abandoning the idea to kill myself, I'm putting my gun down. And at that point, an accident instruction, I think, would apply. And that's why I say, for intent to occur in the blink of an eye, abandonment must also be able to occur in the blink of an eye. And not only...
So how do you respond to the Attorney General's argument and what appeared to be the determination of the trial judge, which is that there is no intent requirement. There's no proof of any kind of intent other than the endangering life, which you essentially concede because there are people around and the gun went off.
And we do
right.
Concede that. I still, you know, after reviewing the case law, feel that there has to be a specific intent for the gun to go off. And then the general intent applies to everything else. I still feel that, you know, reading Fleming, the AG's opinion and all that, I still feel like that is what the court is trying to say. Again, this is very untested waters from what I've read. And just to apply a criminal negligence statute to the discharge of a firearm, any person who drops a gun in a hotel room, any person who drops a gun in their house, or any person who picks up a gun because they think they hear an intruder and accidentally discharges it is guilty of a felony under that status. And I don't think
but not if they don't have their finger on the trigger necessarily.
But most people are not trained. Most amateurs have their finger on their trigger when they pull a gun up. They don't know to put it on the side guard. The testimony trial was the officers don't put their finger on the trigger because they're afraid of being startled or a sympathetic reaction. So the discharge of the firearm can be also viewed that it could have happened after she'd abandoned any criminal negligence, any intent. She may have just been putting the gun down. And without the accident instruction, they couldn't consider that. They had to just determine if a gun goes off in an occupied dwelling, we must convict her. What are we going to do? We're going to give her a fine of $0. And I think that's what speaks. I'm sorry, I'm talking.
No, you have any questions? I think that's it.
Thank you
very much,
sir.
We'll step down and greet counsel and then take up the Thomas case.
All rise.